Millions of military families at risk of losing a major tax benefit. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday, November 11th, and it is Veterans Day. So we'll start today with a story about two tax credits that benefit low-income workers and affect a surprising number of military families. They're set to expire at the end of 2017 unless Congress extends them. If they do expire, it'll be a major financial blow for many people. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
It's lunchtime at Parkview Elementary School in Salt Lake City. Paul Johnson is trying to keep squirming kindergartners and first graders in their seats. Not an easy task, even for someone who was in the Army for almost 3 years.
You guys sit down.
Johnson works part-time, 29 and a half hours a week. He's a monitor in the school's computer lab, which is much quieter than the cafeteria. Johnson gets both the earned income tax credit and child tax credit. They added up to almost $8,000 last year. Johnson and his ex-wife spent the money on their four kids.
You know, buy extra things that the kids might need. Excuse me.
That cough is part of Johnson's disability. His doctor says he froze parts of his lungs during the year he spent in Turkey as an Army private first class.
On a really cold day, I might have frozen some of my lungs and burnt them because it was so cold and we were out exercising.
Johnson started his job at the school last August. He makes $11 an hour, meeting the income requirements for the earned income tax credit, which is sort of a wage subsidy based on how much you earn. It was designed for the working poor, a category that includes some veterans and active duty military, according to Chuck Marr, the director of federal tax policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
So roughly 2 million veteran and active duty, and most of them are veterans, qualify for either the earned income tax credit or the low-income child tax credit.
Marr says Congress made some changes in 2012, making it easier to qualify for those tax credits. But those adjustments are set to expire in 2017, which would leave many veterans out of luck.
If they went away, a million veteran and active duty personnel would be hurt by that, would lose income.
Marr wants Congress to renew the tax credit adjustments by the end of this year. So does Kelly Ruska. She's with the National Military Family Association. It's contacting military families, trying to get them involved in a campaign to save the tax credit adjustments. Ruska says many of them are surprised to learn the adjustments weren't permanent.
And then we say, well, what are you going to do if it expires? And, you know, they've come back and gone, what? It's expiring.
Paul Johnson, the veteran working in the school computer lab, he knows the adjustments are expiring, and he wants Congress to do something about it.
Well, I'm kind of frustrated with Congress right now because it seems to me that they're trying to fix things that aren't broke.
Johnson says the tax credits are working well, keeping veterans like him above water financially, even allowing them to dream. Johnson's goal? To teach middle school social studies full time. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, not a lot of action, but most of it was downhill. We'll have more when we do the numbers. Speaking of the numbers, lots of retailers are reporting earnings this week. Macy's was up today and unveiled its third straight quarter of declining sales. But it was the department store chain's lousy outlook for the next quarter that sent its stock into free fall, down more than 14% at last check. And there's likely to be more where that came from as inventories pile up on store shelves. Macy's put part of the blame on warm weather and also fewer tourists shopping. But as Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports, department stores face an even bigger problem, timing.
Let the seasonal bellyaching begin. Retailers love to complain about the weather. It's too cold. No one wants to shop. It's too warm. No one wants to shop.
It's a convenient excuse.
That's retail analyst Mara Devitt from McMillan Doolittle.
It's something that we have to deal with and we have to plan for. Easier said than done, though.
especially for department stores, which order billions of goods every year. Alexander Chernov is a marketing professor at the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University.
It's a big challenge because if you're like a retailer with a physical location, so most of your sales promotions, they have been pre-planned. Most of your inventory is already there.
For all the talk of fast fashion, many big department stores still work on a calendar where they're ordering merchandise months and months ahead of time. They're promoting it in pre-season sales. Wool coats in September, tankinis in February. But that's not how we shop.
Progressive retailers have learned that the consumer buys more based on need today than they do on desire.
Marshall Cohen is a retail analyst from the NPD Group.
Retailers are beginning to recognize the consumer wants cold weather product starting about now.
Because it's getting cold. Retailers are trying to get more nimble, using data to manage supply, writing more flexible contracts. But department stores have got to stock everything from silk underwear to toddler boots to Christmas tree oven mitts. And when they don't sell, the red pens come out and markdown season comes early for all of us. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Under the Affordable Care Act, insurers can no longer deny people coverage based on their health status. But nobody said anything about charging sick people more for their drugs. A new report out today finds that if you buy insurance on the exchanges created under Obamacare and you need access to HIV medications, you may find yourself on the hook for much of the cost. From our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
In a report from the firm Avalere, more than half of mid-range plans on the exchanges don't cover the 10 most commonly prescribed HIV regimens. Lead researcher Caroline Pearson says her work suggests insurers are trying to keep the sick people away.
If you're a health plan and you're competing against other plans in the market, if you have a lot of HIV patients enrolled in your plan, you're losing money. So there are really very clear business incentives here.
To Pearson, this is how the new insurance game is played under the ACA. Design plans with high out-of-pocket costs that encourage expensive patients to knock on someone else's door. Perhaps the clearest example, says Harvard's Robert Greenwald, is how insurers are switching consumers from a flat copay fee to coinsurance, where a person pays a percentage of their medication.
The insurers are saying, oh, we can't keep people off. We can't charge people higher premiums. I've got it. Let's change the way we do coinsurance.
Greenwald considers these practices a violation of new civil rights protections under the ACA. But John Bertko, an insurance actuary with 40 years in the business, says these practices are less about discrimination than they are about getting good deals from pharma. Remember, says Bertko, every health plan must offer some HIV drugs, but not all of them.
The question really is, do people really need every one of those drugs, or can plans be able to bargain a bit?
Bertko says limiting access to drugs is one of the few ways insurers can negotiate with drug companies. He says if a consumer really needs a certain drug, they should appeal. And most times, he says, the consumer will win. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
T-Mobile just announced a new program that lets its subscribers binge-watch video from a few select sources without any of that streaming counting against their data caps. So if you want to watch every episode of Game of Thrones on HBO Go or a bunch of Netflix shows all in a row, all on your phone, you can, and you won't get charged extra. But the binge-on service launched to a little bit of controversy yesterday. Marketplace tech host Ben Johnson is here to tell us a little more. Ben is also the host, I should say, of a new podcast called Codebreaker that launches today. But before we talk about that, let's talk about this binge-on thing. Hey, Ben.
Hi, Molly.
So what is T-Mobile's new data offering, and how does it fall under this definition of zero rating?
So T-Mobile is basically saying here that as long as services like Netflix and HBO Go, ESPN, etc., adhere to its technical standards, it will provide their content to users without running up their data bill. And that's pretty much the definition of zero rating. Zero rating in the world of wireless companies and internet service providers is this idea that the service provider doesn't charge the end user any money for data used by specific services.
Why are so many people concerned about this?
What's interesting about this, Molly, is this has net neutrality advocates pretty worried. And what they're worried about is, say you want to be the next Netflix. You're this scrappy startup making video or other data-heavy content, and you want to get it to users. Well, you were really happy when the Federal Communications Commission upheld rules that were friendly to net neutrality, or this idea that users deserve equal access to all content. But this deal, this T-Mobile binge on deal and things like it under zero rating, sort of moves the control of this to the carrier. They're giving, quote, free access to the content to get the consumer on board and excited about that. But it's sort of a transition of power.
Right. And it seems like what T-Mobile is doing in some ways is exploiting this zero rating loophole in net neutrality regulations. But it looks great for consumers, right?
Absolutely. It looks great for consumers. And it's interesting, the FCC is really focused on whether consumers are being price gouged or hurt in the process of delivering content to end users. And because of that, the FCC isn't as concerned with this zero rating thing, because in the end, the consumer gets the content for free. But if you're a net neutrality advocate, Molly, you have to be looking at this and being very worried about the future of how we get and use data.
Yeah, you know, I think zero rating has become more and more an interesting conversation. It's the thing that allows Facebook, for example, to provide access to some free services in the developing world, and that's been controversial. You know, if it's a loophole in net neutrality, T-Mobile just drove a truck through it. But I want to ask you a question about zero rating that I think you will appreciate. Now, in your new podcast, Codebreaker, which just launched, you're asking the central question about all kinds of technology, and that question is, is it evil?
Is it evil?
So let me turn the tables on you while I have you, Ben Johnson. Zero rating, is it evil?
I think that on the one hand, you can look at this as a consumer, and we're all consumers, and say, giving me a ton of bandwidth to do what I want with the services that I want access to, not inherently evil. But if that comes with a price, and that price is smaller companies, newer companies, competition is hurt, I do think that that is probably bad for competition. It's bad for innovation. And in the end, I think it's probably bad for the end user. So I would say that result is evil.
So speaking of is it evil in the podcast, tell me what's going on with Codebreaker. It's an unusual format, yes?
Yes, it is. There's a code in every episode. And if you want to binge it like a Netflix show, you can actually decipher the code in each episode to unlock the next episode, Molly. So the first episode that's out today and free to listen to, of course, is about email. And then we explore one kind of technology in every episode going forward and ask whether or not that piece of technology is evil.
All right. You can get that podcast starting today via iTunes or however you download your podcast. Thanks so much, Ben.
Thank you, Molly.
Coming up,
if we're losing and we get £1 million a month, well, we're losing about $25,000 a month.
Tough times in America's dairy industry. But first, let's do the numbers. The numbers are down today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dipped 55 points, 0.3% to close at 17,702. The NASDAQ declined 16 points, also 0.3% to finish at 5067. And the S&P 500 subtracted 6 points, you guessed it, 0.3% to end at 2075. You're so good at math. Apple might be getting into the mobile person-to-person payment business. That's according to the Wall Street Journal. Apple fell 0.5% today. We told you earlier about the headwinds facing retailers. As we mentioned, Macy's gave back 14% after cutting its profit outlook for the year. Other retailers felt the cold. Kohl's shed 5.3%. Nordstrom lost 3.7%. JCPenney refunded 1.8%. Dillard's dropped 8%. Urban Outfitters returned 7.3%. And Kate Spade unstitched 4%. Turning to online shopping, Amazon clicked up 2%. Alibaba, the Chinese e-commerce site, slipped nearly 2%. But today is Singles Day in China, billed as the world's largest e-commerce event, and Alibaba said sales topped $14 billion. Bond trading was closed for Veterans Day. You're listening to Marketplace. You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Last night's Republican presidential debate focused intensely on immigration, which is obviously a big issue across America, including in some potentially unexpected places, like America's Dairyland, where economic pressures have forced many dairies to close and others to get much bigger. From Wisconsin, Zoe Sullivan has more.
Wisconsin is known for its cheese. The cheese-shaped hats that Green Bay Packer fans wear are a quirky reminder of the state's $50 billion dairy industry. Yet a tough market means that many farmers are having to choose between going out of business or expanding to achieve an economy of scale. The Nelson Farm is a family-run operation with 450 cows. Don Nelson has lived in this community his entire life and raised his children here on the farm. Still working at 85, he told me that at $16 a hundredweight, the price of milk is lower than their costs.
If we're losing and we get 1 million pounds a month, well, we're losing about $25,000 a month.
This kind of price squeeze has helped drop the number of dairy farms from more than 22,000 in the late 90s to fewer than 10,000 now. For those that remain, immigrant labor has proven crucial. A 2007 University of Wisconsin study found that 40% of the workers on these farms were predominantly Mexican and Central American immigrants. Five of the eight full-timers on the Nelson farm are immigrants. Nels Nelson tells me about his pay scale.
Some of them get housing. The ones that get housing, I think, were $11.50 an hour. Some of the ones that don't get any housing, I think up $13 to $15, somewhere in that range.
For many U.S.-born local residents, these wages, without health insurance and other benefits, aren't worth a 24/7 schedule involved with milking hundreds of cows. And then there's the risk of injury. Farming is one of the most dangerous occupations in the United States, with more deaths than in mining or construction. Near the milking parlor, I meet Pablo Hernandez, one of the farm's Mexican workers, whose head is half covered with white gauze bandages.
I was putting them in, but then they moved back and pushed me.
Sure, and you fell down.
And I hit my head on one of these water tubes, and a lot of blood came out. A lot of blood. Like you had opened up one of these water valves.
Immigrants are often willing to put in the long hours for lower wages than U.S.-born workers. And that has helped many Wisconsin farmers stay afloat. But some farmers are less than scrupulous. Ignacio Garcia earned $10 an hour on a farm with more than 10,000 cows before he says he was fired unjustly, and he turned to a workers' rights center for help.
And this person started telling me, look, these are your rights. What you did is fine, and your boss was abusing you, even if all you were doing was standing up for your rights. But that's not okay, because the law says X, Y, and Z. So I realized they had broken a bunch of laws.
Despite such abuses, farmers recognize that immigrant labor is fundamental to their operations. I'm Zoe Sullivan for Marketplace.
Now, when I say gold standard, you might think I'm talking about something that is the best, the most perfect, the ultimate. But when economists say gold standard, they have something very different in mind. It's a system of currency, one that's come up a few times in the Republican presidential debates, including last night when Senator Ted Cruz brought it up.
Look, we had a gold standard under Bretton Woods. We had it for about 170 years of our nation's history and enjoyed booming economic growth and lower inflation than we have had with the Fed now.
As Marketplace's Sabri Benishor reports, the gold standard might sound like the best, but it's a real tough sell to economists.
In the movie Goldfinger, a terrorist targeted the international supply of gold to create total havoc.
The Goldfinger.
That would only work in a true gold standard world.
Barry Eichengreen is professor of economics at UCLA. That only work because in that world, every dollar in your pocket would be tied to gold.
If you had $20 worth of banknotes, you could take it to the bank and demand gold in return.
Now, the reason some people nowadays like that idea is because it takes control of the currency away from people and gives it to gold. Keith Wehner is with the Gold Standard Institute.
Today we have central planning. We have the Fed and its chair, Janet Yellen, and the other PhDs that are running around.
Right now, the Fed controls the money supply. But the problem with giving away control of the money supply to gold is that you're giving away control of the money supply to gold.
So if you had a big gold discovery in South Africa, and there's a lot more gold in the world, that would mean you would be expanding your money supply.
Ted Truman is with the Peterson Institute. Another example, what if India started buying up gold and the gold started leaving the U.S.? We would have to raise interest rates to convince people to keep their gold here. Even if we were in a recession, we'd have to raise interest rates. It wouldn't make much sense. Another problem, says Richard Silla, professor of economics at NYU.
Gold wasn't produced fast enough to keep up with the growth of the economy.
Literally, there's not enough gold for the economy. In the 19th century, that caused serious deflation. All these reasons are why, in some surveys, 0% of economists think the gold standard is a good idea for the U.S. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The San Diego Chargers and Oakland Raiders' hopes of building a new shared stadium in Los Angeles got a pretty big boost today. Bob Iger, the top guy at Walt Disney Company, is now spearheading the stadium effort. Meanwhile, another NFL team, the St. Louis Rams, is also angling to move to Los Angeles. Now, to be clear, LA hasn't had a professional football team in more than 20 years. Marketplace's Annie Baxter looks at why the NFL is suddenly so interested.
Los Angeles has long been useful to the NFL as a bargaining chip when a team somewhere else wants a new stadium. Comedian John Oliver says this is such a cliche that you'll even find it in the football video game Madden NFL.
If you want a new stadium, a good way to do that is to relocate the team. And the game even tells you the easiest choice financially is, guess where? Los Angeles.
But over time, it starts to look a little weird for the NFL to keep using the second largest media market in the country for that kind of leverage, according to Smith College economist Andrew Zimbalist.
And there's been a lot of pressure on the NFL to bring a team back to Los Angeles for that reason.
Zimbalist says one reason the NFL has managed to do without a team in Los Angeles has to do with the rise of fantasy sports betting, where fans assemble fantasy teams with players from several different real teams. That diffuses the importance of an NFL team in any one city.
They get lots of interest from people in Los Angeles, even though there isn't a team in Los Angeles.
But Zimbalist says a team in L.A. will mean more luxury box sales and bigger sponsorship deals. Plus, there's this.
It is the number one Hispanic media market in the country.
E.J. Narcisse is with Team Services LLC, a sports marketing consulting firm. He says even if Latinos aren't football fans today, they can be converted.
Their parents may be soccer fans, but the kids who want desperately to become a part of this culture rapidly become NFL fans.
The league is expected to decide on a team for Los Angeles at its winter meeting after the Super Bowl. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
This final note before we go, the Financial Times reports today on yet another car recall related to a problem with airbags. But before you worry that you're in danger, know that this recall affects only one vehicle. Not one type of vehicle, just one car. It's a Rolls-Royce Ghost 2. It hasn't actually even been delivered to its North American owner yet. But during a safety check before Rolls-Royce sent the car on to the customer, engineers noticed that one of the airbags had incorrect labeling. So they issued a recall notice. To be honest, that is the kind of individual attention you would expect when you pay close to $300,000 for a car. The Rolls-Royce recall isn't actually the only time a single car has been recalled for a problem. The Financial Times says a 2002 Porsche 911 Carrera got singled out, and so did a 2013 Koenigsegg Agera supercar, which had a problem with a tire pressure warning light. Okay, and one more time, please do go check out our new baby, the Codebreaker podcast hosted by Ben Johnson, and available today wherever you podcast. The music is good today, but it was the sad music on Wall Street. The Dow dipped 55 points, 0.3%. The NASDAQ down 16 points, and the S&P 500 subtracted 6 points, 0.3%. Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. I am Molly Wood, and Marketplace will be back tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.